Let me go on to my next guest, who is in our London studio. Bonnie Greer has given us the first volume of her memoirs. It's called A Parallel Life. She was born in Chicago in the late 1940s, but for most of the last three decades, she has lived in the UK. Probably best known to Irish audiences for her contributions to BBC Two's Newsnight Review and Question Time. For most of her life, she's been a writer. Her work includes two novels, three plays, an opera, and two musicals, including one about the relationship between, or the connections between, Marilyn Monroe and Ella Fitzgerald. Bonnie Greer, as I say, joins me now from studio in London. Bonnie, the Chicago of your childhood, how dangerous a place was it growing up there in the 1950s?
Well, it was. I grew up in a early part of my life in a gang neighborhood, and there's still gangs. So it might even be more dangerous than it was when I was a child. I mean, it seems to be. A lot of kids are getting killed there because they're, you know, having to go to schools in territory that's gang territory. So it's probably a little worse.
You actually, though, at one point in the memoir, you describe one house that you lived in, one of your childhood homes, that looked out over an alleyway, and you saw and heard things that possibly no young girl should ever see or hear.
Well, you know, as a child, you don't, when you hear things, I mean, I heard gang initiations, and they had to do with women being sort of, you know, sexually used. But when you're a child, you don't know what's going on. But it still sort of eggs into your consciousness anyway. And so it was pretty much a part of my kind of unconscious landscape, too.
You talk about growing up with the blues people. How important was music, and that music in particular?
Well, I mean, my late father is from Mississippi. My mother is from Tennessee. If you are black and you grew up on the south side of Chicago, any part of Chicago, Midwest, it's always about the blues. So the blues permeates everything for me. And you know, it was kind of astonishing to come to the United Kingdom and to find out how many people knew anything about the blues. Because, you know, being American, we don't know that anything exists outside the United States. So it was quite a shock to discover that, and a pleasant one as well.
And your attachment to music, was it purely as a listener and as a viewer or as an audience member? Did you ever partake as a singer or as a player yourself?
Well, I'm a synesthete, which means that I can sort of, if one sense is stimulated in me, another one can sort of send off something else. So I hear music all the time. And so music is an integral part of me. I can't separate myself from music. And I've sung, and I've sung in a band and stuff like that, but I can't play an instrument. We were too poor to have them. So I'm just sort of kind of watch other people in envy as they play.
You do actually, though, talk about how music and memory are linked for you. And it's not just a matter of, oh, you hear a song and it brings you back to a certain year. Could you tease out the nature of how music and your memory are interlinked?
I was lucky enough to be a teenager in the 60s. I was very lucky now that I look back on it, because it was a huge musical era. And just in a very short amount of time, when I was a very young child, there was rhythm and blues, and there was Motown. Then when I became a teenager, there was British music and Irish music, and then the great folk music and women's music, and then again disco. All of that sort of was in the arc of 20 years. And when I think back on it, that's a really small amount of time to have such wonderful music. So music isn't anything that can be separated from me. It's not possible. And like I say, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk about in the book is to celebrate the connection that music has with me personally, but also with the various incidents and things that I went through as a young person.
One of the relationships that comes out, certainly your heroes, your mom and dad. How?
Yes.
I mean, I guess it seems like a foolish question to say how important were your parents to you in your life, but just how important and how influential would you say they were? You do refer to them as your heroes.
Well, it's, you know, you don't, I only remember myself desperately trying to get away from them. They were very protective of us, and probably a little overprotective. So that's my only memory. But my dad is gone now, but my mother's still alive. And they were, as a couple, very staunch, very devoted to one another, and very devoted to being parents. And that kind of drama of watching these two people who are relatively young in our day and age, having a family at 20 and 21 is considered quite young now. And to watch these two people actually grappling with their relationship, grappling with their own selves as young people, and then trying to do, quote unquote, the right thing by their children, was a big template for me because it was a push and pull template, and in many ways still is.
You describe the moment of your first menstruation and your mother's attitude to that. What did she say and do?
I think she was a typical 50s mother, and in many ways, a black mother. Black women, we tend to we're very, very protective of our daughters, extremely so. And for me, and for her, menstruation was something that was kept secret. You didn't let anyone know you were doing it. That it was happening. It's nothing like it is today. So for me, it was just a series of hiding, 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 because I menstruated relatively early. So I had to be kind of tippy-toey around my girlhood because this was going on.
And in terms of that hiding and I suppose being invisible and keeping certain things secret, where did you look to, or could you look anywhere to find women and black women, perhaps specifically, who were role models or potential role models for you, or were black women often in hiding or living in secret in some way?
Well, the first woman who really struck me was seeing Miriam Makeba on this show called The Ed Sullivan Show. And this would have been when I was 12 in the early 60s. And that was striking to me because she looked so unlike all the women that was sort of in my neighborhood. Her hair was different. But I think a real big role model for me was Cicely Tyson, who, an actor who was in a TV show in which she played a social worker. She had her hair in a natural way. And she wasn't in drama. She wasn't somebody who was running away from the police or nobody knows the trouble I've seen type of person. She was someone who was doing a job, and she was an ordinary human being, and the show treated her like a human being. And it's one of the things I wanted to say in the book was that I really wanted to try and write a story about a girl growing up who discovers all of these things around her that define her, but at the same time, she tries to find out who she really is in the midst of all of that.
Perhaps on a lighter tone, on a lighter note, and possibly not a role model, but certainly an obsession, it would seem, of both you and your sisters. How many sisters were there, by the way? Just
Three.
three.
I have
So
three sisters, yeah.
Shirley Temple was an
Oh,
obsession, was she?
listen, it's funny because I it took me a while to decide whether I was going to put that in the book. Because when you read a story, especially in this era about black women, women, you have a lot of burden on you in a way, and you think, well, maybe I shouldn't say things like this because, it's not really a good thing to do. Maybe it'll be a negative, a negative to say. But when I was growing up, Shirley Temple was the big icon, and I had tons of Shirley Temple dolls. I adored Shirley Temple, and my father was trying really desperately to get us to relate to ourselves, brought a black doll home for me for Christmas. And I was just outraged. I just kind of like exiled her from, my little row of blonde baby dolls. And you see that as part of sort of the invisible life, that it's not correct for a black woman to say. There's some kind of sort of thing where, you wake up and you're righteous from day one and you carry on that way and that's the way it always is. And that isn't at all. People are complex, and my life is and was complex.
That's interesting, though. Do you think, as a child, then, that in terms of your even your dolls, if you mentioned there that you were colorblind in some ways, and that you saw Shirley Temple just as somebody you wanted to watch on the television as a young child, were you aware of color as any sort of an issue at that point?
Well, I grew up in the civil rights movement, so I turned on the TV every day, and you saw little kids like me being denied access to school, being surrounded by police, and all this sort of thing. So, and my father came from Mississippi. We fought in the segregated army, and he came over in this country for D-Day. So, race in those days was always something that was present, but like with any child, you always find a space where you escape to, where you can be yourself. And even if you can't expose that self to anybody else, that's where you go. And that's where you take your music. That's where you take your clothes. That's where you take your records, all of that. And that's what I did.
Unfortunately, I would have to say that my Irish compatriots who might have been in Chicago, the Chicago PD at the time, and indeed the Polish you mentioned as well, they don't come out of this story too well.
Not when I was growing up. Chicago, you know, as you know, is a big Irish town, and it was run by the Irish when I was a kid in the 50s and 60s. We had a mayor, Richard J. Daley, who had been mayor since I was a little girl, and I thought his first name was Mayor. I had no idea he had another name. And, you know, the Irish on St. Patrick's Day, they turned the river green. You know, you had to get in this big sort of Kremlin-type parade where you marched down the street and everybody was oh this or oh that. I think the Irish in Ireland would be actually quite embarrassed in a way by how this sort of over-the-topness of Irishness was. And there was a clash because the Irish, of course, and African Americans and people and Polish people were working class people. So there was a fight for jobs. So where do you go when you're trying to defeat the other person? You go where you can sort of do the most damage. And unfortunately, the Irish community in those days went to racism because that's where they could actually, you know, at least begin to get some kind of edge. It took me a long time to understand that. And, you know, the other flip side of that were the nuns who taught me were all Irish, and they were incredible people. And so, you know, I had that kind of balance in my life.
What was the reaction of those nuns to, I think, what was, if not your first, certainly a very early play about the Virgin Mary on the brink of giving birth to the Christ child? Give us the plot.
Well, I don't even know how I did this. I had her sort of in the manger or whatever. I'm trying to remember this thing. I think it's the best thing I ever wrote. And she kind of is just, you know, trying to understand how she actually could be pregnant because, you know, she was a virgin. How she could she do that? And I put that in the play. And I saw them. I can still see the nuns, you know, in those days they wore the wimples, you know, they had the full drag and everything. And they were sort of huddled together in the corner, whispering to each other, how did she know this? How did we can't put this play on. And I thought, well, it's very logical because my mommy is the mother of seven children, and she had her children very fast. So I saw my mother pregnant a lot. Well, you know, I was trying to actually make sense of the whole thing. I didn't see any point in writing the play unless you asked that question. So it did. I still don't.
One of the things that might surprise, and certainly surprised me, was your attitude to Martin Luther King.
Mm.
How would you describe that attitude? Because am I right in thinking that you haven't read anything of his in the last five decades or so? You haven't looked at pictures of his?
I can't.
Why not?
Well, I was sort of getting ready for a date when the news came over the transistor radio that he'd been assassinated. And it was something like 6:10 in the evening on April 4th. And honestly, I couldn't, from that day, I can't hear his voice. He was like a father figure to me. And when that happened, something inside me just stopped. Something inside me just stopped thinking about dreaming anymore. And that was something, it's like a kid, I put that away. And I can't hear him, I can't see him. There was a 50th anniversary this year, or last year, the March on Washington. And I was asked to say some things, and I did, but I don't want to see that again. I don't think I could look at it again.
This first volume only brings us up to the age of you at the age of 30. You're not even in England at this point.
Not even thinking about it.
Are there more volumes to come?
Well, yeah, if I sell this one, I think so. I moved to New York, and then I move into England, and I, in fact, go to Ireland as well. So, you know, hopefully that will happen.
Right. Well, we look forward to hearing and seeing them when they come about. The first volume, in the meantime, of Bonnie Greer's memoirs, it's called A Parallel Life, and it's published by Arcadia Books.